Last year in Illinois, nearly 200 people's lives were saved by bone marrow transplants. But that leaves more than 300 others in the state still on the waiting list. These are people with leukemia or other cancers who can't be helped by other treatments and need a transplant from someone who isn't in their family. It's hard to imagine what it's like to be in that situation, but Brendan Harley knows. He received a bone marrow transplant at the age of 17. Now he's a cancer researcher and an assistant professor at the University of Illinois Department of Chemical and Biomolecular Engineering. Dr. Harley is our guest on Focus today, and he'll talk about his research and his experience as a bone marrow recipient. But no one can be a recipient without a donor, so we'll also talk with Shelley Baker of the Be the Match Registry, part of the National Marrow Donor Program. I'm Jim Meadows. Our conversation on Focus begins after the news. Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. The American Cancer Society celebrates its 100th anniversary tomorrow. A group of physicians and businessmen launched the society back in 1913. If you go to the society's website at cancer.org and add /fight/100-stories, you come across a feature entitled 100 Stories of Hope, profiling several cancer survivors. And at number 11 on the list is our guest today on Focus. The American Cancer Society funded the research that made Brendan Harley's bone marrow transplant possible, and now the Society is funding some of Dr. Harley's research at the University of Illinois. We'll get into that later, but right now, Dr. Harley, welcome to Focus.
Thank you for having me.
And with us on the phone is Shelley Baker of the Be the Match Registry. That's part of the National Marrow Donor Program, which helps line up people willing to donate bone marrow for people like Dr. Harley when they need that tissue. Shelley, welcome to Focus.
Good morning, and thank you.
Dr. Harley, you were just a teenager when you received a bone marrow transplant?
Yes, I was a junior in high school and was diagnosed with leukemia. And as part of the treatment process, it became clear fairly early on the only available treatment for the type of leukemia I had was a bone marrow transplant.
Can you tell us anything about what it felt like? I mean, I had my share of teenage angst when I was that age, but I was not facing any life-threatening diseases. How did you handle that at the time?
Well, I think I handled it in a manner that in hindsight was really good, and part of it was because I had a great support system. I had family and friends who were really invested in seeing how I was and not just treating me as a patient but treating me as a person. And so that gave me a bit of perspective, I think, on it. And beyond that, it sounds weird, but I've talked to a number of other cancer patients, and a lot of them have had a very similar thought process in that you almost don't believe that it's possible anything bad could happen, and that I sort of compartmentalize things down into a series of treatments or a series of processes, each one of which had a high degree of success. And when you put it all together, you walk out the other end, and that's kind of the perspective that I had.
And I understand you had two brushes with cancer. Was that the first one?
That was actually the second. I really made it hard for my folks, I think. When I was born with something called a neuroblastoma, which is a tumor mass in my belly. And that was removed when I was 1 year old, and I was treated with chemo. And then 15 years later, I had leukemia. So I'm going to try to keep it to two cancers now.
And tell me, did you have any difficulty finding a donor for the bone marrow?
Fortunately, no. You hear lots of stories about people that go through horrific attempts to try to find a donor. And it became clear the first night that I was diagnosed, the doctors came to my parents and said, he's going to need a match and he's going to need a donor in order for us to successfully treat that. And the first step for testing was actually testing my siblings. So I had two brothers and my mom was an identical twin. So they also tested my cousin. And fortunately, one of my brothers came back as a perfect match, and we didn't have to go any further than that, although if we had, we would have had to turn to a marrow registry program.
And we'll be getting into that in just a moment. I do want to mention that if you have questions or comments about bone marrow transplants, you can call us here on Focus at 333-9455 or call us toll-free at 1-800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 1-800-222-WILL. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We also welcome your questions on Facebook and Twitter at Focus 580. And Shelley, I wanted to ask you, it's natural to expect that a family member would be the donor for tissue like this if you're looking for compatibility. How often is that possible, and why is it not possible in other cases?
Well, we only have a 25% chance of finding a match from a sibling. So, you know, 70% of the searching patients are having to look for an unrelated donor of their similar heritage. That's how we're typically matched with a patient. We're looking at the human leukocyte antigens that are these little proteins or markers that are found on the cells, and it identifies someone's race and ethnicity, and someone's diseased immune system will recognize this donor's marrow or umbilical cord as similar to theirs, so that they can reproduce more cells, more healthy cells.
So this is a case where race or ethnicity makes a difference in compatibility, or at least as a marker towards compatibility.
Oh, yes. That is definitely what we're looking for when we're matching the donors and the patients. Race and ethnicity is the key factor. Our need to build diversity on the registry, racially and ethnically, is great. You know, people are likely to find a match anywhere from 66% to 93%. So in certain communities, there may be a greater difficulty because there's a lot more racial diversity within their background.
Well, Shelley, it's one thing to, say, sign an organ donor card for things to be done after you're dead, but living people donate bone marrow. What does the process involve? And how is it painful or dangerous even?
Well, there are a lot of misconceptions, and I like to think that, you know, we're sharing a gift that we all have that can help support a patient and their family. But there's two ways of donating. 75% of the time, we're collecting these stem cells through a process called peripheral blood stem cell collection, and it's a non-surgical process. It's outpatient, and it's very similar to donating platelets or plasma. You'll be receiving a medication prior to the collection that helps boost your blood-forming cells. And 25% of the time, they're doing the marrow extraction, which is a surgical outpatient procedure. It takes place in a hospital, and there's always a form of anesthesia used. And, you know, the donor goes through a complete screening beforehand to make sure that they're healthy and they don't have any health conditions that could be exacerbated. So not only are we looking out for the patients, but we're taking good care of the donors as well.
Well, Brendan, I'm wondering, when you received the transplant, what was it like for you?
Well, I'll talk both sides, actually. I'll talk about my brother's experience as well and myself. And so I will say that my brother, Peter, was my donor, and he actually went through the what is now the much more rare form of donation, which is through the surgical collection. So back in the mid-90s when I was treated, that the peripheral recovery wasn't really an option yet. And so he went through the process where it was surgical removal. He was a freshman in high school and went through the process, and within 2 weeks, he was back running on the cross-country team. So he was a little sore, and obviously it was a surgical procedure. I'm not trying to play that down, but it was one that he handled quite well and went out the other side. For me, it actually – the process started what is now a lot of what my research is. It got me fascinated in how some of these hematopoietic cells work, is because I remember going to the bank with my mom in the summer before my bone marrow transplant. I was diagnosed in May, went through a series of rounds of chemo to get me ready for the bone marrow transplant, and was in the bank, and one of the tellers there — I grew up in a small town, and so that everyone knew that I was sick — and the tellers was wishing me luck in my surgery for my bone marrow transplant, because people thought of it as a kidney transplant or a liver transplant. And the fascinating thing for me is that my brother went through this process where they isolated a whole, quite a large amount, almost a liter of bone marrow from him that was going to be transplanted into me. But the process by which it worked is that I received it like you would a blood transfusion. So they showed up with a bag of marrow, hung it up on the IV power, and put it in through one of my ports they had implanted in my chest. And these hematopoietic cells start floating around the bloodstream, make their way back into your bones, set up shop in the bone marrow, and start producing a whole new immune system. And I thought that was a fascinating process. We didn't have to, as the medical field didn't have to go in and inject it into each one of the marrow cavities. They did it themselves. And so it started this whole process of me trying to understand, how does this work, or are there ways we can improve it?
Okay, so now I had read, tell me if I'm accurate in this, that essentially before the bone marrow can be transplanted into a recipient's body, mm-hmm. essentially their existing a marrow system has to be destroyed as far as being a blood producer. Is that correct?
Yes. So I was diagnosed with leukemia, and that is there was a mutation in the process of me producing all my blood and immune cells. And so we have these hematopoietic progenitor or hematopoietic stem cells that all of us have in our body. They make almost all of our blood and immune cells. They make all of our blood and immune cells, almost a trillion cells a day, with very low error. And so in the process of leukemia and a number of these other hematopoietic diseases, something goes wrong in the marrow, and you start producing lots of immature, or in my case, leukemic cells. And so the problem is my immune system. It's not a tumor somewhere else in the body. It's the immune system itself. And so the process by which doctors like to treat you is they give you chemotherapy or radiation. And the goal when doctors normally treat you is they want to give you enough of a dose to try to kill as many of the cancerous cells as possible. But they have to leave behind a little of your immune cell to repopulate your marrow and to keep you healthy. Otherwise, you won't have any new blood or immune cells being produced. So oftentimes when you have really virulent diseases or some forms of leukemia, you can never quite get rid of all the leukemic cells because you can't destroy all the patient's own marrow. And so the process of bone marrow transplantation basically throws that caution to the wind and says, all right, we're going to give a dose of chemo and radiation that just has to be sublethal, is going to destroy all of your marrow, and in the process hopefully destroy all of the leukemic cells as well. The catch is you no longer have an immune system. So that's what this transplant is, providing the immune system from a donor patient that sets up shop in the recipient's body and starts producing all the new blood and immune cells.
Now, this occurred to me when I was watching a mystery TV show. I think it was Elementary the other day, if I remember correctly. And the problem-solving moment came when Sherlock Holmes learned that the suspect had been a bone marrow transplant recipient and had not tested positive for, I think, a genetic identification through a previous blood test. And Sherlock Holmes deduced that's because he was a bone marrow transplant recipient, and that therefore had different DNA in her body. And then a saliva swab produced a more accurate reading. Is that even close to real life?
I've always threatened my brother with something like that. Yeah, it is my brother's immune system that is still working in my body. And it's mine now, but it was based off his cells. And there's a process by which his immune system had to adjust to my body. So there is, As a bone marrow patient, I got to interact with a number of other previous donors and hear all sorts of weird stories. I didn't actually hear an actual criminal story. I want to put that out from the beginning. But, I mean, things about allergies that transferred, lots of things that transferred back and forth between the donor and the recipient.
Okay, but that hasn't happened to you, but then it was a member of your family as well.
Yes, yeah.
We have a caller waiting, and I want to say hello to line one, Christine in Savoy. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Good morning. I have a question. I've been on the donor registry for about 25 years, and I'm in my mid-50s now, and I was just curious, is there an age limit for being considered for a bone marrow transplant?
Well, we actually right now we're targeting people that are 18 to 44 when we're signing new people up. Mm-hmm. We found that 90% of the time the donors who are actually being called to go on to transplant are in this age group. However, you will be on the registry till your 61st birthday.
Okay.
So there is still a chance that you may be called. So what's really important is that you keep your address, your contact information updated, as well as your health information with us. And you can do that at our website, bethematch.org.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you very much, Christine. And that leads to some other questions, Shelley. I'm just wondering, you've already mentioned an age range that you're looking for. What other health considerations are involved as you look for potential donors?
Well, we do have some health guidelines that people need to, you know, meet those requirements before joining. We need people that are in fairly good health. There are some, you know, if there are any health related issues to the heart, that may be a deferral. If someone has any back issues, that could possibly be a deferral as well. And we have all of those guidelines on our website, but we're continually updating that list, making sure that the, you know, the people that are signing up are in good health, as well as so when they're donating their stem cells to the patients, that the patients are getting healthy cells.
When a donation is made, does that even temporarily reduce the donor's ability to produce their own blood?
Well, it, you know, all of, when you donate your marrow or your stem cells, they all reproduce. Like I mentioned earlier, we're just sharing a little gift. And I think Brendan had mentioned that his brother in 2 weeks was running on the track field again. So, you know, shortly after the donation, you know, you probably don't want to run a marathon the day after. You might have some soreness in your lower back region if you're doing the marrow donation. And if you do the other procedure, the peripheral blood stem cell collection, you may have some nausea and joint pain prior to the donation because you're taking that medication that boosts your blood-forming cells. So I liken it to, you know, all of these cells want to be released, so you're feeling a little achy. And then within 48 hours after the donation, that feeling goes away.
Okay. Shelley, I understand there's a big need for people of mixed racial heritage to join the registry. Could you go into that?
Yes. We mentioned earlier that, you know, we're matching people based on, you typically match someone based on your race and ethnicity, and we know it's a very diverse world. So, you know, what we're wanting to do is have more ethnically and racially diverse people join the registry so that when patients have a need, they're able to find their match at that time. Timing is critical. I joined over 16 years ago, and I'm of mixed heritage. So, you know, there are certain groups, too, that have much more diversity. I mean, in the African-American community, their likelihood of finding a match is only at about 66%, as compared to the Caucasian community, it being 93% that they'll likely find a match. So, you know, we just need more diverse people joining the registry, so that more patients can benefit.
This is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, and we're talking about bone marrow transplants with the recipient of such a transplant, Dr. Brendan Harley of the University of Illinois, and we're talking with Shelley Baker of the Be the Match Registry, part of the National Marrow Donor Program. If you have questions about bone marrow transplants, or if you or a loved one has received a transplant or donated tissue and like to talk about it, give us a call at 333-9455 or call toll-free at 1-800-222-9455. Or you can email your question to will-talk@illinois.edu. The phone number again, 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL. Besides phone or email, you can send them to us on Twitter or Facebook at Focus580. Brendan, I was wondering, when you received the transplant, how long was the recovery process afterwards, since you were already not well to begin with? So there must have been a road back afterwards.
There was a road back, and the road back today is much different than the road back that I had even almost 20 years ago now. So I was by no means one of the first people to get bone marrow transplants. That the science extends back a long time, but there was a number of differences in the protocols. And so I had gone through a number of rounds of chemotherapy, and the idea was to sort of beat back the leukemia as much as possible to get myself ready for this transplant. The transplant itself was about 6 weeks in the hospital. And the really interesting thing about the process is that your body has to assemble a whole new immune system. And so when my brother's bone marrow was transplanted into me and set up shop and started producing blood and immune cells, it was almost as if I was starting again at zero. So I had my baby shots again. I had to go through a process of being isolated. So I spent the first year, actually my senior year in high school, so the first year after I had been treated, at home in isolation. And so the biggest worry that people have with transplant patients, after you make it through the transplant, the high doses of radiation and chemo, you get out the other side in a release, the biggest concern they have is you getting sick, getting an infection, getting a disease, because your immune system isn't capable of really fighting it at that point yet. And so I was home but isolated. And so it was a process by which I was slowly exposed to my family, to extended friends. I went through my baby shots again as an 18-year-old. And then by the next summer, so a year out from my transplant, I was officially cleared and was able to resume normal activity. But it was a long process. Early parts were you were still nervous about the leukemia coming back. But after about the first 6 months, I had passed a number of tests. And so I was pretty confident that was over. And then it was just a matter of being a senior bored at home.
Now, it's now what, 10, 15 years later?
It is 18 years this summer.
What would the process be like now? I don't know if either you or Shelley could give an idea of what happens now for a bone marrow recipient.
I can say a little and then maybe Shelley could add in. The other thing I'll mention is that a lot of these protocols are very specific to the hospitals by which you were transplanted in. So I was treated at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, and they had a relatively strict regimen post-transplant that included this full year of isolation. And there were some other centers in the country that performed these transplants that didn't require quite as long of a isolation period. And so there is a little bit of medical center to medical center variation. But I know there's also been quite a bit of a change in understanding of how the science works and how rapidly things progress. And so maybe Shelley can comment on that.
Underneath the HIPAA regulations, we're prevented from commenting on any specific patient cases. But, you know, as Brennan had mentioned, you know, it's taking a while for the patient's immune system to get strong again. So, you know, we're looking – each patient's story is different. But typically within 2 to 6 weeks, you know, that's when the marrow cells start to produce a more normal production.
Okay. Would a recipient still expect a sort of year-long quarantine?
It may not be a year-long, but there's certainly a quarantine period, and the time of which depends on a number of things. And I was relatively young and relatively healthy for a leukemia patient. Most of the other people that were being treated on the bone marrow floor at Brigham Women's with me were in their 40s or 50s, or it had chronic leukemia. I had an acute form of leukemia. And some of those patients were in much worse shape, and so their prognosis was took a lot longer for them to get back up to a fully healthy.
And that raises the question: once you are considered fully healthy and have made a full recovery, would you qualify for being a bone marrow donor?
I'm not even qualified to donate blood. Unfortunately, and I understand the risk is that, you know, I'm permanently unable to donate blood or platelets or be a bone marrow donor. However, you know, I can use my story to try to motivate others to do it. But unfortunately, I can't. But I know that, you know, when I was sick, my father's company started a program where they had people would go and donate platelets and blood regularly. At Brigham and Women's Hospital, I was being treated, and there's still people that he works with that to this day still do it almost 20 years later.
Is the medical reason simply the fact that you are someone who had leukemia, and we don't know enough about leukemia yet to really identify its total behavior? We just don't know what would happen.
Yeah, I think it's partially that I had leukemia. In general, cancer patients and. There's a sense that we don't know the total story of a lot of these diseases, and so that the worst thing that you could possibly do would be to get someone else sick in this manner. And so it's out of abundance of caution that they typically do it.
Well, that's one person that Shelley can't turn to. But Shelley Baker, why don't you tell me a little more about how you find people to be bone marrow donors?
Okay. Well, you know, I wanted to mention, as Brendan was saying, that you know, he wasn't able to join now, but that he was going to share his story. You know, we're not only adding people to the registry, you know, diverse populations between 18 and 44, but we need volunteers and advocates to continue to share their stories and the message, because we're recruiting across the nation. We go to businesses, to colleges, to family outings, you know, wherever there's an opportunity for us to educate people and dispel the myths that go along with becoming a marrow donor, that will give us an opportunity to add more people to the registry. So there's so many ways to help, you know, joining, volunteering and sharing your story and hosting registration events, or helping us with fundraising. It costs us about $100 to add one new person to the registry. So we're always looking to create fun and exciting fundraising events that give people an opportunity to help in other ways, to help be the match in other ways. And when you're joining the registry, you're filling out a simple consent form, you know, really understanding what the commitment is and meeting the health guidelines. And at this day and age, we're using little cotton swab or buccal swab kits for the inside of your inner cheek, and that's how we get the samples of the cheek cells to put people on to the registry.
I'm looking at your website now, bethematch.org. Would mm-hmm. that be a good place for people to start, just to find basic information and find out how to take action if they want to register?
Yes, Jim, definitely visit our website at bethematch.org, and it'll speak to, you know, joining the registry. You can join online. You can do some outreach if you'd like to host an event in your area. If you'd like to volunteer or possibly participate, we've been doing these walk runs across the nation. So that's another great way to join Be the Match.
Tell me about the walk runs, because in a few minutes I'm going to talk a little bit about the American Cancer Society's Relay for Life, but I want to find about, and now I have it up on the website here, the Be the Match walk run.
Yes.
Are do these also take place at various localities around the country?
Exactly. We're going into our fourth year. I'm out here in California, but it's a great meeting place. We have recipients that are participating with their family. We have people who have actually donated, people who are on the registry and haven't donated yet, you know, all the supporters of Be the Match. We have physicians and people from the community that have helped support our work. So it's a great day to bring the community together, and people are sharing their stories. And these walk runs help us to raise funds to help with patient services, helping us to add more donors to the registry. So it's very similar to the other organizations that are doing community events, but we're really excited because it's our own event, and we hope that more people will consider coming out and either joining us in walking or running, or consider becoming a sponsor.
What sort of distance do people cover for this event?
It's typically a 5K.
Okay, for 5 kilometers, and I'm looking at one here, 5K, 1K, and a something for children 5 and younger, which
exactly.
I guess is under 5K probably.
Yeah, and my first year, I was probably the last one because I was visiting with everyone, but I felt like, you know, I can always make my time better the next year, but it is a great day, so we hope more people will start coming out.
Okay. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be back in a moment with more on bone marrow transplants. This is Focus on WILL. We're back on Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, speaking here with bone marrow transplant recipient Dr. Brendan Hartley of the University of Illinois, and with Shelley Baker of the Be the Match Registry, part of the National Marrow Donor Program. Their website is at bethematch.org. You can call us and talk to Dr. Hartley and talk to Shelley Baker with your questions and comments at 333-9455, or call toll-free at 1-800-222-9455. And we also are on Twitter and Facebook at Focus580. The phone number again, 333-WILL, 1-800-222-WILL, or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. And Brendan, I wanted to talk to you. You were not planning originally when you were a kid on becoming a cancer researcher, but I take it your bout with leukemia did have an influence on what you do now.
It did, although it sort of a roundabout way got me back to cancer research. Growing up, I was playing with Legos all the time and building stuff. And so by the time I got to high school, I was pretty sure I wanted to go into engineering and hadn't really considered much about how an engineer could contribute perhaps in the health field. I was imagining more of a traditional engineering job. And then I got sick and basically spent the next year hanging around doctors. So one of the real advantages of being sick is it was an incredible learning experience. As I mentioned, I was being treated at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, which is part of the Harvard Medical School system. And so what that meant is that it was a teaching hospital. So every time I got my temperature taken by a doctor, I then got it taken seven more times by the med students who were there learning how to be doctors. And so over the period of every day, I got a lot of chance to interact with young medical students and talk to them about, you know, what they wanted to go into and what I wanted to go into. And I found out that a bunch of them had engineering backgrounds in college and had done research in more of the area of bioengineering and had been something I never considered. And so I decided that that's really what I wanted to try to go into. And I wasn't sure it would be for cancer. I went off to college and got a degree in mechanical engineering and spent some time working in a leukemia lab in the summers. I used one of the doctors I had met in the hospital and said, hey, could you use an assistant in your lab? And so I got to see what research was like. Went off to grad school and did work that you might consider more tissue engineering, building biomaterials to implant in the body to heal orthopedic injuries. And then sort of roundabout came back to the idea of looking at the bone marrow. This idea of how bone marrow cells worked or how they homed back into the bone marrow got me started on some research that I'm doing now as an assistant professor here in the chemical engineering department.
And this is research that is funded by the American Cancer Society?
Yes. Yeah. The American Cancer Society has been a really great part of my lab's growth. You know, as an early researcher, a junior faculty member, it's all about building your research portfolio, building your name, becoming a known entity in your field. And the American Cancer Society took, you know, a risk on a young faculty member like myself to fund some of the early research in my lab that was aimed at building an artificial bone marrow. And in this day and age, it's an incredibly important thing to get early research support, especially in this day and age of declining federal funding for research.
When we're talking about an artificial bone marrow, I should ask, have we built one yet?
We have variations. We don't have a full bone marrow working yet. I think that's a very long-term goal, but I think we have different versions that my students are hard at work on right this moment.
Now, artificial bone marrow, you mean for something that can actually work like human bone marrow tissue, or something that could be something that is inside the body, or something that would just be studied outside the body?
So we have research efforts that are going down both arms, although the one that is the most developed is the one trying to produce an ex vivo, so outside of the body, bone marrow platform, as a way that we could either study some of the fundamental behaviors of hematopoietic or leukemic cells outside of the body, or because I am an engineer, there's some aspects we're interested in. Can we produce a platform that could be used clinically as a diagnostic tool or to produce patient-specific blood and immune cells?
Okay, so for something that I think you were using a phrase, something along the line of beyond the Petri dish when we were talking off air.
Yeah, sort of the averaging between a Petri dish, which is flat and stiff and plastic and unlike any environment cells typically see in the body. And then on the other end is the actual bone marrow itself, which is an incredibly complex and diverse tissue. And it's one that is very difficult to study because it's hard to stick a microscope into a human or an animal to study some of these fundamental processes. So we're trying to create a three-dimensional environment that in some ways simulates different elements of the bone marrow environment to study how processes such as the initial activation of hematopoietic cells or one that relates to bone marrow transplants. One of the most difficult things in transplants these days, or has always been, is the efficiency by which these cells home back into the marrow. And so we're trying to understand how the process is that these hematopoietic progenitor cells go from the bloodstream back into the bone marrow and set up shop. And are there ways that we can improve the efficiency of that process to make bone marrow transplants work more better?
And when I'm thinking of marrow, I'm wondering if I'm thinking of it correctly. So we're getting into vocabulary definitions. Mm-hmm. Is the marrow the substance that produces new blood cells, or is the marrow the places where cells that produce new blood cells live?
It's the latter. And so the bone marrow itself is a tissue. It's mainly cellular. So you have lots of different types of cells you find in your bone marrow. You have these hematopoietic stem cells that produce all of our blood and immune cells. You have mesenchymal stem cells, which are responsible for producing a lot of the connective tissues in our body. Then there are mature blood and immune cells. There's fat cells. There's vasculature. There are different extracellular matrix proteins. These are the building blocks of our tissues. And they're all distributed in an incredibly complex three-dimensional environment that these cells are constantly moving and redistributing. And most importantly for these hematopoietic cells is they have all the information in their DNA and how to produce blood cells or immune cells. But in order to do that, they take information from their environment to tell them when to go through these processes. So we're trying to understand how do you engineer an environment to act as a rheostat and actually drive a particular behavior.
Okay. So, you know, with the research you're working on right now, what changes in treatment or just changes in ability to study the entire process do you hope your research could help make possible?
I think there's a couple of really interesting avenues. I have one element of this process is very much interested in can we produce more activated hematopoietic cells that could be responsible for repopulating a bone marrow more efficiently. We're also very interested in using this as a platform to study things such as bone marrow failure or response to radiological insults or the initial formation of leukemic cells. All these are processes that happen very rapidly within the marrow environment, and it's very difficult to study those without but the platform we developed actually gives us some unique insight into this process.
I heard the phrase more efficiently, and I'm just wondering if that's a step, if that step could be reached. Would that mean that, for instance, bone marrow donors would not have to donate as much tissue, or if they could help more people with the tissue that they do donate?
It's probably be the former of those two. I imagine Shelley could comment on it, but I imagine there's very little call for the same person to donate twice, however, especially in very short order. But certainly one of the things we are interested in is can you make the process much more efficient? Can you make it so that the marrow cells that you are transplanting set up shop more quickly and produce bone marrow more efficiently? All those things are definitely things as an engineer I think we can contribute to.
Okay. And I guess, yeah, that's a question, Shelley, for donors. What would make your life easier as far as or make the donor's life easier as far as the scientific developments you'd be hoping for?
Well, I think, you know, we're doing our work for the patients, and our goal is that we have enough available donors on the registry so that if a patient's diagnosis is calling for a marrow transplant, they have the donor when they need it, because the sooner a transplant is performed, hopefully the outcomes will be better. So the need to build the registry, you know, unfortunately, it's about 12,000 patients every year are told that they will need to have a transplant in either to cure the disease or to halt the progression. Brendan mentioned something about for the donors and having to donate more than once. You know, typically when someone is identified as a match for a patient, we do stay in touch with that donor for an entire year. If for some reason the patient does relapse, we have a connection to that donor so that they can do a secondary donation. For us to make it easier for the donors and better for the patients, it's just really having more awareness of what we're doing so that we can have more donors on the registry so that when the patients need them, they'll be there.
Okay. 12,000 people, that's 12,000 people every year who
Yes.
are needing bone marrow transplants in the United States. About how many transplants actually take place in a given year? Is there any idea?
Excuse me, but it was approximately
5,500 last year. I mean, we've been doing the transplants for 26 years, and there have been 55,000 transplants. We've made that possible. But, you know, with 12,000 people every year and last year having a little over 5,500, you know, we still have a need to add more people to the registry. And since it's an aging registry, you know, the fact that people are removed when they're 61, and we're really needing to target 18 to 44-year-olds because they're being called 90% of the time, we really want to get the communities out there to learn about it and join. So we'll have more donors.
And that is the situation. The figures I said at the beginning of the program, I believe, was in Illinois last year, there were nearly 200 who received transplants, but more than 300 still on the waiting list. How many people are on the national registry right now?
Nationally, we have 10.5 million.
Okay. And, of course, the idea, that sounds like more than enough, but you have to find the right match.
Exactly. You know, as Brendan was saying, there's the different protocols that the doctors have. Each patient, you know, patients may have leukemia, they may have other health issues as well. So it's a very complex treatment, and each patient's physician works with them on what's best for them. But we just need a much more diverse registry. Our world is a very diverse place, and many people may not even know what all of their ancestry and their heritage is. So the more diverse people we get on the registry, hopefully the more patients we'll be able to benefit.
This is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, and there's still time for your questions about bone marrow transplants with bone marrow transplant recipient Brendan Harley. He's a cancer researcher now at the University of Illinois, and with Shelley Baker of the Be the Match Registry, part of the National Marrow Donor Program. You can find them online at bethematch.org. Brendan, I was wondering, you had leukemia, but there are other ailments that could require a bone marrow transplant besides leukemia.
Yes, there's a number of different types of ailments that can be treated. The most common is leukemias, but you have, you know, in I've heard of patients, you know, when I was on the bone marrow floor, there was a woman being treated there for breast cancer. And in reality is the bone marrow transplant is the last-ditch effort in some ways for a number of different forms of cancers, where the goal is trying to complete, you know, put the highest dose of chemo and radiation you possibly can on the patient as a last-ditch effort in order to try to destroy the cancer that's there. And that's really the way in which it's been used, although primarily it is used for hematopoietic diseases such as leukemia.
Okay. We have a caller on line two, Bob in Champaign. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Good morning. I'd like for the people to explain again three things. How do they get the bone marrow? How do they determine if it is a match? And how is it, after it's obtained from the donor, how is it administered to the patient? And the fourth question is, why do they have pain in the lumbar region? And that is all. Answer those, please.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Bob. And, well, why don't we start with question number one? It's not always bone marrow itself that we go to?
Well, so when I received my transplant, the way that they got the cells they needed was that you just harvested a whole lot of bone marrow from the donor. So my brother had to give a large amount of bone marrow. And the rationale behind that is the hematopoietic stem cells, which are the cells you really want in order to set up the new marrow in the recipient, they're incredibly rare. Maybe one in 50,000 or one in 100,000 cells in the bone marrow is one of these hematopoietic stem cells. And so the way you get around it is you just take a lot of marrow, and there's going to be some of these stem and progenitor cells within the marrow. You administer that marrow to the patient, to the recipient, and those hematopoietic stem and progenitor cells are the ones that set up shop in the recipient's bone marrow.
And how is that harvested?
So the surgical harvest was harvested from the iliac crest, so the back of the pelvis. So that's where the lower back pain comes from, is that the surgeon takes a needle and they puncture into the bone and suck out the marrow. Now, that was the old method, the surgical method.
Is that still done sometimes?
It's still done occasionally, and there's different medical reasons why you might target one or the other. But the other method that Shelley talked about is process by which they take it out of your blood. So one of the really fascinating things about these hematopoietic stem cells is that in your normal lifespan, they're sitting in your marrow producing all the different blood and immune cells. But some of them also do something called mobilize, which is they move out of the marrow into the bloodstream. They float around in the bloodstream and do things like immune surveillance. They then go back into the marrow, home back in, and go back to work in the marrow. And so these HSCs, the stem cells, are already floating around in the bloodstream sometimes. So the medication that Shelley was talking about is there's a medication they can give to increase the number of these stem and progenitor cells and increase them to start mobilizing. So they end up more and more in the blood. And so then they do a process by which they take blood out of one arm, they spin it in a centrifuge to isolate out this one cell population, and they give the rest of the blood back to you. And so it's a process that doesn't need surgery. And really, they're targeting just the cells they want, when in the old days, you might say, they couldn't target just the cells they wanted, so they just took all of them.
Okay, and make sure we're answering Bob's questions. Those are two different ways in which the needed cells are harvested from the donor,
mm-hmm.
Either the old way, which is certainly a lot more painful, and the new way, which is more like a blood transfusion.
Well, it's more like donating platelets in terms mm-hmm. of how they isolate the cells. How the recipient receives either the bone marrow or the stem cells themselves is the same. It's like getting blood transfusion yourself. And the answer is, last question, they don't actually harvest the marrow until they know you're a match for someone. So what they do is they just take as Shelley was saying, a swab inside of your mouth in order to look at these HLA antigens and match you that way. And so if you become a match, then they go to you to actually isolate the marrow.
And that's something, in case you were thinking that perhaps they were, once you sign up, they take your marrow and they freeze it somewhere. It doesn't work that way.
They don't come to you until they are certain that they have a match, and see if you're, and even then it's still up to you as to whether you want to go through with it.
Okay. And that's,
yeah. And it, can I just mention something? You know, there are the two different ways to donate, but when we are registering people and educating people about the process and what the commitment is by joining, you know, it is a voluntary donation, but we really encourage people to really understand both procedures, and we really need them to be comfortable with both donation procedures, because the patient's physician will be choosing which procedure will be performed based on the patient's illness. So we really want to give that hope to the patient, so that, you know, if you're willing to do one procedure and not the other, you know, you're really not available to all patients. So we need people to really understand that it's important to be comfortable with both donation procedures before joining, so that if you get the call to be screened as a potential donor and then possibly becoming the perfect match, that you will definitely be committed and move forward. And I always encourage people, you know, if you're not comfortable with both procedures, like I'd mentioned before, there are so many other ways to be a part of Be the Match, by volunteering or helping us with fundraising. So there's many ways to help if you're not quite comfortable with doing both of the donation procedures.
Yeah, and actually my brother went through the same thing. Even though he was, you know, my brother, the doctors were very concerned that he would psychologically feel absolutely compelled to have to do it, and not because he was my brother. And so they set him up to talk to a number of people who had donated so he could get comfortable. One of them actually turned out to be his favorite fourth grade teacher, which he hadn't known, had been a donor. And so it talking to other donors actually made him understand the process much better. And it was a really valuable part, as Shelley says, is you need to make sure that these people who are on the registry are committed. And it's an important aspect, and it's important to have the right services for them so that they can get the information they need.
BeTheMatch.org is the address for the website to learn more about the National Bone Marrow Registry. One of their fundraising efforts is the Be the Match Walk Run across the country at various locations. But also the American Cancer Society has its own Relay for Life which is going on, I'd say, in at least a half a dozen locations in our listening area over this summer. And you've spoken at a lot of these events, I understand, Brendan.
Yes, the Relay for Life is really a fantastic opportunity to engage with the community. And as Shelley said, one of the big things is to be engaged with patients, with family members and caregivers. And Relay for Life was a great opportunity for me to go out and talk to some of the patients, recipients, caregivers about the research that they're helping support. As an American Cancer Society funded researcher, I'm very proud of the work that we do that's funded by them. And I know that it would not be possible without their support. And so to be able to go out, see some of these events, they're all night events. It's part of a process to sort of as a metaphor for what cancer patients go through the middle of the night of their treatment into the morning of being better. And it's really an emotional and wonderful opportunity.
And I should note there are several of these going on over the next two or three months throughout East Central Illinois and Western Indiana and across the country, actually. If you go to relayforlife.org, you can find out more about these events. That's about all the time we have on Focus today. We've been talking about bone marrow transplants with bone marrow transplant recipient and now cancer researcher Dr. Brendan Harley of the University of Illinois, and with Shelley Baker of the Be the Match Registry. That's at bethematch.org. It's part of the National Marrow Donor Program. Thanks to both of you for coming on Focus today.
Thank you very much. This is a great opportunity.
Thank you.
And we welcome any additional thoughts you have about today's program on our website. You can go to it directly at will.illinois.edu/focus. Today's show was produced by Lindsay Moon. Other members of our Focus team are Pam Dempsey and Kimberly Cronick. Jason Croft is our technical director, handling your phone calls. Tomorrow on Focus, social media and privacy rights. Right now, Illinois law bans employers from asking employees and job candidates for access to their social media accounts like Facebook and Twitter. But a new legislative proposal in Springfield would relax those restrictions. Are there times when a boss has a right to look at a worker's social media? We'll discuss the issue with law professor Lori Andrews of the Chicago Kent College of Law, and also with State Representative Jim Durkin. He's the sponsor of the new legislation. That's on Wednesday's show. Focus is live each weekday morning at 10 with a replay at 8 p.m. And you can listen at any time at will.illinois.edu/focus. I'm Jim Meadows. This is Focus on WYLL.